For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
If you're a fan of horror movies, then I'm sure you know the name Jason Voorhees, the machete-wielding, hockey mask-wearing villain from Friday the 13th. In the Friday the 13th movies, Jason stalks his victims near the shores of picturesque Crystal Lake. It's a story that taps into our most primal fears about what might lurk in isolated places, where the serenity of nature can mask unspeakable violence. Most of us find comfort in knowing these are just movies, fiction designed to thrill us before we return to the safety of our everyday lives. But in the winter of 2024, those fears materialized around an idyllic lake in eastern Iowa when the body of a 20-year-old woman was discovered on its banks, her back bearing deep slash marks consistent with a machete attack. Although nobody realized it at the time, just 24 hours before a murder, a person close to the victim had changed their Facebook banner to an image of Jason Voorhees. And it wasn't a coincidence, nor was it a tribute to a fictional killer. It was a warning sign that went unnoticed until it was far too late. A digital breadcrumb leading to a real-world horror that would shock an entire community. Join me now as we dive into the horrific murder of Melody Hoffman, a 20-year-old woman at the center of a deadly love triangle. You'll hear how a mother's desperate attempt to protect her vulnerable daughter through constant digital surveillance couldn't prevent an unthinkable tragedy, and how a late-night trip to a Walmart to purchase machetes set in motion a chain of events that would end in murder. On the morning of February 18th, 2024, Amy Robas pulled into the parking lot of Lily Pond, a scenic park located just southwest of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was just after 9 a.m., and a low fog hung over the air. For Amy, the pond was a familiar, quiet spot where she could park her car, listen to audiobooks, and watch the birds glide across the water's surface.
I usually go there a couple times a week, at least, depending on weather, listening to an audiobook, watching geese and the ducks, thinking about what I wanted to do for the day, and some things that were going on in my life at that time. Peaceful, sort of quiet. There's not much there except the lake, and there's a couple of picnic benches right along the shore by the parking lot, and a lot of people park there and walk the trail that goes around the lake. A few people will go and picnic there, but for the most part, people will park and do what I was doing and just kind of appreciate the beauty of the spot while they're doing things that they need to do, sort of making their days a little bit better, I think, with that nice, pretty view.
That morning, Amy sat in her car for about 20 minutes before noticing an older couple approaching her vehicle on foot.
They were acting strange. I actually felt really nervous seeing them because they were clearly agitated. They were older than I am and coming towards me, kind of waving. And so I rolled down my window and they were immediately asking for help. And so I ended up getting out of my vehicle to find out what was going on.
Despite her initial apprehension, Amy listened as the couple explained what was making them so upset.
They pointed towards the shore behind the picnic pavilion and said that they had been walking and saw something over there and they didn't know what it was, if it was a dead animal or if it was a mannequin or if somebody was playing some kind of prank, and would I go over there and look?
But what they found was no prank. As Amy walked toward the shoreline, she saw a human form lying in the grass. It was a young woman's body, wearing only a bra and underwear, her bare skin exposed to the elements.
I knew she was young because she had the most beautiful, pale, perfect skin and glorious curls. And she was not moving in any way, shape, or form. She was not appropriately clothed. There were slashes and gashes all over her. Her hands were curled in a way that they shouldn't have been. She was not breathing. I was fairly confident, just even from a distance, that based on positioning, the temperature, the way she was laying, the not being clothed appropriately, that she was deceased. Honestly, I've tried to forget. I try not to think of her like that.
Amy wasted no time dialing 911 and reporting what they'd found.
This is Sarah with the Iowa County Sheriff's Office. I've got an ambulance on the way, and I've got some deputies on the way. Okay, so you said that she's on her stomach?
She is on her stomach, yes.
Does it look like she was in the water?
No.
Okay, and is there anything else around her?
There are all kinds of marks on her back, like slashes. I'm wondering if there might have been a sexual assault too.
I have deputies on the way. If you could just
Okay. Yes,
we're waiting away from her. But if anybody does go to her, just tell them to get away, please.
Before hanging up with the dispatcher, Amy noticed something disturbing. There were goosebumps on the victim's skin. The sight made her wonder if there might still be a chance they could save the young woman's life.
I noticed she had goosebumps, and I at that moment thought maybe I was wrong because she had goosebumps, so maybe she just was not well and really cold, and I told 911 and they said, no, don't, because I thought maybe they would tell me to go assess her, and they said, absolutely, stay back. Don't touch her, which I had not at that point, nor did I.
The dispatcher didn't want Amy to investigate the goosebumps because of the gruesome truth. Rather than being a potential sign of life, the presence of goosebumps was, in fact, the exact opposite. Goosebumps on a victim's skin is a telltale sign of early rigor mortis. Deputy Mark Teat of the Iowa County Sheriff's Office was one of the first officers at the scene.
So she was lying face down on the ground. Her head was to the east. Her feet were to the west. Her arms were down to her sides, kind of spread out a little bit. She had all kinds of lacerations across her back and then some stab wounds on her back as well. Her underwear was pulled down over her buttocks, and then her bra had been pulled up towards her shoulders. She was not wearing any other clothing besides that. And to me, obviously, she was clearly deceased as well.
From the very outset, it was clear the young woman's death was a homicide, the victim of a brutal attack with both blunt and sharp instruments. But very quickly, the deputy noticed something extremely peculiar about the crime scene.
There was very little blood, actually. Little bit of blood, but there was no blood pooled anywhere on the ground. To me, it was almost as if that's not where the scene occurred, the actual homicide occurred, because of there was no blood anywhere, really.
As investigators continued their examination of the young woman's body, the evidence pointed to an even more disturbing scenario. The young woman hadn't just been stabbed. She'd been restrained and tortured before death.
We observed more injuries on Miss Hoffman. You could see that where she appeared to almost have been strangled, like ligature marks on her neck and markings on her wrist and ankles as well.
With no ID on the body, investigators carefully documented any potential clue, including a heart-shaped tattoo and a class ring. A ring that would soon solve the mystery of the victim's identity.
So once we took the ring off, on the inside of the ring was the name engraved of Melody Hoffman. And we performed a record search through the Iowa driver's license system, and we were able to obtain a photograph of Melody Hoffman, and that is how we identified her.
She was just 20 years old at the time of her death. Melody Marie Hoffman was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on December 9th, 2003.
Outgoing, bubbly, lively, caring, loving, compassionate, would do anything to help anybody or animals. She volunteered at the animal shelter.
Melody's mother, Megan Hoffman, describes living with her daughter in Marion, a suburb of North Cedar Rapids.
I can say that I never had to clean our apartment because she did. She loved to clean, sometimes a little too much. I came home one time and the cupboards were all cleaned out and they looked fabulous, but the food cupboard I noticed was missing a lot of stuff, and I said, "What happened to the macaroni and cheese?" "I threw it away, I don't like it." And I'm like, "Oh, well then."
Despite not having a job, Melody kept busy by helping family members and volunteering.
She was helping my mom and her step-grandpa out a lot. They only live a mile away from us. Mom has chronic hip issues, back issues. Phil also has back issues. So she'd hop on the city bus and go over to their house and help them out.
While Melody loved nothing more than helping others, she sometimes needed guidance herself to navigate the complexities of adult life.
She had a mild intellectual disability. So instead of her being able to process everything at what you would think a 20-year-old would be able to process stuff, it was more like she processed it at a 14 or 15-year-old's ability. She was on disability. She didn't have a vehicle. She did learn how to ride the public transportation well, but we just kind of played it safe, and she didn't have to have a job. And I thought she would get great social interaction at the animal shelter.
Melody's vulnerable and trusting nature required Megan to take an active approach in her daughter's life.
She would come talk to me about things all the time. She was very open with me, and I would help her, and I think that helped her a lot. She just trusted everybody. She would be easily persuaded. I can think of a couple of times that kids at school had said, "Hey, why don't you do this?" And she did it, and then she got in trouble. And then eventually down the line we figured out, oh, that was suggested to you by somebody else. I was just thankful that we had an open line of communication and I could help her determine certain things.
While Melody's innocent nature could make her vulnerable to unkindness, it was also a source of her most beautiful quality, a genuine desire to spread joy to everyone she met. One story shared by her mother perfectly captured the essence of who Melody was.
She and I were shopping at the mall, and we were walking, and some lady, and she was an elderly lady, and I was thinking, wow, I think that Christmas sweater came from the 80s or 90s. It was very loud and bright and bells and glitzy and stuff, and I was like, whew, Next thing I know, Mel's walking up to that lady and says, I like your sweater. And I know I had a look on my face. We walk past this lady. I go, did you really like her sweater? And Mel's like, no, I just wanted to see her smile.
The special bond between Melody and Megan was built on honest and open communication. Melody knew she could always tell her mother anything. Megan knew that this kind of communication was essential to protecting Melody as she navigated the world. To encourage Melody's independence safely, Megan created a digital safety net around her daughter.
We had a code word where if she sent that to me, I knew, like, okay, I would call her and be like, hey, what's up? Something's going on, tell me. Very trusting relationship between her and I. Also, I had a camera in my living room. I had Life 360 on her phone. She had me as emergency contacts, and there were many things that we had in place for her to see where I was and for me to see where she was.
What Megan couldn't have known was that these very safety measures would later help investigators piece together her daughter's final hours. Like many young women her age, Melody started dreaming about finding romance, and in the fall of 2023, her mother noticed Melody spending more time on her phone, particularly dating apps.
I know that she was on, like, dating app and or dating website or something, and she'd be like, Mom, look at this guy, he's really cute. Mom, this guy has a nice car.
Megan would go so far as to say that Melody was downright boy crazy in October when she met 23-year-old McKinley Luisma on a dating app. McKinley, who was born and raised in the Bahamas, had only recently moved to Cedar Rapids in 2020.
He was very polite, very helpful. We sat down and I laid down my ground rules for being in my home. They weren't just for him, they were for both of them. After a while, like, he would go grocery shopping with us. He would go to the laundromat and help carry the laundry. We would go out to eat.
Within weeks of meeting, McKinley and Melody were in what seemed to be a serious relationship. Megan even allowed McKinley to spend nights at their house.
It appeared to be very good, and like, they were together all the time, and I never seen an argument or a fight or a nothing like that. It was, like, caring, and when I got home, the supper would be made, or, you know, they would be working on it, and I'd be like, okay, guys, you're not going to go hang out in the other room. I've been gone all day. Get out here and hang out with me. Let's watch a movie. Let's play Uno. Let's, I don't know how many games of Uno we played, but Melody loved Uno.
But by early January, cracks started to appear in what seemed like a perfect romance. McKinley had grown increasingly unreliable, and Megan began to notice a pattern.
He just, I don't know if it was just bluntly lying to her. She had many phone conversations on speakerphone, and I would hear him say, I'll be there in 5 minutes. 2 hours later, he was nowhere to be found. And that happened more and more and more frequently over time, to the point that I was like, okay, I'm tired of seeing this happen. He's playing games.
Melody and Megan would come to learn that McKinley had been harboring his secret. His ex-girlfriend, Nikias Voboda, was pregnant with his child.
I knew he had a lot going on. I knew of a possible baby, and he wanted to be in that child's life and help take care of it. I respect that. And I always would tell her, don't make his problems your problems. You have your own problems. He has his own problems. Don't make his problems your problems. And after me sitting for nights on end consoling her because he didn't show up again, that's when I was like, okay, you make the decision, but this is what I see.
By the end of December, McKinley had been secretly reconciling with Nikia, and eventually, Melody realized this was the reason for his recent flakiness. So on January 6th, 2024, Melody officially broke up with McKinley. That very next day, she received a disturbing message from an unknown number. Melody showed the message to her mother.
Just know that you're a dead girl. Don't worry, when you least expect it, we're gonna get you. Call the cops if you want. They're not gonna protect you. All the time, you retarded ass bitch. I hate you, and I hope you and your family ain't safe. Bitch boy, on GD, we finna to make it red and paint your whole house red.
Megan reported the threatening message to police. She feared that the message had been sent by McKinley in retaliation for the recent breakup, but the message had been sent through an app that couldn't be traced back to anyone. For a couple of weeks, Melody cut off all contact with McKinley.
I think for a while they completely just stopped talking, but I do know that they started talking again, and she was open with me and let me know. At that time, it wasn't boyfriend-girlfriend, it was just friendly chat.
On February 17th, 2024, Melody and Megan spent what would turn out to be their final day together.
We got up, had breakfast. We went to Sam's. They have these chicken tacos that Melody really liked. Then we went to Aldi and got groceries. We went to Starbucks. That was her absolute favorite place. We went back home, put all of our groceries away. I made supper, and she laid on the couch for a little while. Her hip was hurting. We just chilled for a little bit.
As the evening approached, Melody and Megan settled in for what seemed to be a typical Saturday night.
I was like, hey, the couch isn't comfortable for both of us to lay on it, so why don't you come lay on my bed and we'll watch a movie. So we went in there and laid on the bed and watched a movie. The movie ended right about 11:15.
After the movie, Melody returned to her room while Megan scrolled on her phone, planning to fall asleep. By 11:27, Megan received an alert on her phone informing her that Melody had left the house. Whenever her phone left the house, a GPS tracking app would send a message to Megan. Upset that Melody had left so late at night without telling her, Megan sent Melody a stern text message that read, "Are you kidding me right now?" To which Melody replied simply, "I'll be back." Around 11:45 p.m., Megan opened up the Life360 app to check on her daughter's location. The GPS data showed that Melody was near Morgan Creek Park, about 15 minutes away. This location wasn't random. Megan knew McKinley's parents lived there. Given that Melody didn't really have any other friends she might be visiting that late at night, Megan assumed her daughter was seeing McKinley again. Around 1 a.m., Megan received a series of Snapchat messages from Megan's account. "I am on my way," and "Can you leave the door unlocked for me?" Something about these messages struck Megan as odd.
After reviewing it and not being like worked up because I was mad that she wasn't home, that's just not how she talked. Instead of saying "I know," she would say "IK" or abbreviate stuff, and last set of messages were more spelled out.
For the first time that night, Megan felt genuine concern rather than parental frustration. But that concern would soon turn to terror at 3 a.m. when another emergency alert lit up her phone.
She had set up for people of her choosing as an Apple SOS message that would detect an impact. So I received a text message around 3 a.m. that there was an impact detected.
Megan immediately got in her car and followed the GPS coordinates provided by the emergency alert. She pulled over to the side of an on-ramp off the highway, relieved that there was no sign of a traffic accident. But as she sat in her car trying to make sense of the situation, she decided to use her iPad to trigger the Find My iPhone alarm on Melody's phone. After a few attempts, she heard a faint electronic chirping. Following the sound on foot, she found Melody's phone lying face down on the side of the road.
So I went to the police department around 10 o'clock hour sometime. And I said, I'm here to report a missing person.
At almost the exact same moment Megan walked into the police station, deputies were already responding to Amy Robas' 911 call at Lily Pond. Megan was still at the police station when she was informed that Melody's body had been discovered. As detectives began investigating Melody's murder, the medical examiner made a surprising discovery during the autopsy. Melody's death was not caused by the slash marks and stab wounds on her back. Instead, she died from ligature strangulation. The wounds on her back were determined to be post-mortem, meaning they'd been inflicted after she died, something that would account for the lack of blood discovered at the crime scene. Based on Megan's information that Melody had likely been with McKinley that night, investigators obtained a search warrant for McKinley's Honda Accord, and they were shocked by what they found inside. There was a machete with a handle that matched a blunt force strike mark on Melody's face, and there was a pocket knife with her blood on it. There were also torn pieces of Melody's clothing in the trunk, with pieces of duct tape still clinging to them. A length of paracord matching the ligature marks on Melody's wrists, her iPhone case, and the wristband from her Apple Watch was also found. Detectives also discovered a receipt from Walmart showing the purchase of two machetes and gloves at 10:15 on Saturday night, approximately 1 hour before Melody left her home that night. But when investigators reviewed Walmart's surveillance footage, it showed McKinley, but he wasn't alone. With him were two young men from the area, 18-year-olds Dakota Van Patten and Logan Kimpton. Police in Cedar Rapids already knew that these three together meant trouble. Back in January, the trio had already been accused of violently assaulting another man together. At the time of Melody's murder, both McKinley and Dakota were currently out on bond awaiting trial. Logan, McKinley's roommate, would be charged for the same crime a week later. Now that they knew of Dakota and Logan's potential involvement, investigators subsequently searched Dakota's residence, where they uncovered damning evidence directly linking him to Melody's murder. Investigators found a length of nylon towing rope in Dakota's basement, which matched the ligature marks on Melody's neck. But perhaps even more chilling was the discovery of Melody's clear-framed glasses. Dakota had not only kept the glasses, but his phone revealed he'd taken a selfie wearing them after she died. Through cell phone records and surveillance footage, investigators established that while Logan Kimpton had gone home after the Walmart trip, McKinley and Dakota had driven together to Melody's house. With mounting evidence pointing to a premeditated murder involving multiple suspects, investigators brought McKinley in for questioning.
A little bit of basis for what we're looking into. We're looking into a case involving Melody Huffman. Sounds like you guys used to date for a while. Yeah. Do you remember the last time you had a chance to speak with her?
The last time I speak with her was on the phone. She told me to come over.
Okay. And then on Saturday, did you show up?
On Saturday, no.
Okay. So did you talked to her, but did you not see her on Friday and Saturday? Okay. When do you think was the last time you saw her?
The last time I seen her? The last time I seen her was that one day I went to her house and we hung out for a bit and I left.
Okay. Unfortunately, a little over 24 hours ago, Melody was found. And unfortunately, she was found deceased.
Really?
Yep. You kind of said really when I said that. Had you heard from anybody or talked to anybody about rumors about her situation?
It just surprised me just now.
Okay, yeah.
Not knowing what detectives had already discovered, McKinley flatly denied knowing anything about what had happened to Melody. The detective then asked McKinley to explain why he'd purchased two machetes on Saturday night.
I was told I was going somewhere and we were pretty much going muddy and sort of camping. And just went in there and grabbed a machete.
And it was your idea that, okay, if I'm going to go camping the way that you guys describe this, for your own personal protection, you need to get a machete?
Yeah, because they were pretty much hyping it up, saying it's in the middle of nowhere, it's dark, and there's creepy stuff. I'm like, yeah, I'm grabbing a machete.
McKinley claimed he'd spent Saturday night playing video games with a friend, but admitted letting another friend borrow his car for about 45 minutes in the middle of the night.
I was involved in anything. I was actually where I said I was.
Right. Yeah, and unfortunately the case facts don't indicate that at all.
Okay. The guy said if I want to be done with this, I can be done with this and I can leave because this is just too much for me right now, man.
Okay. So what are you saying?
I just want to be done and just leave, like you said.
McKinley ended the interview and was free to leave, but a few hours later, he was back at the police station, asking to speak with the detective again. And this time, McKinley had a very different story to tell.
Yeah, so the first interview is pretty much accurate, but there are some things that was left out.
Okay.
So I texted Mel, say, hey, I'm doing something right now, I'll be on my way. She said, well, can you be here before 11? So I said, yes, I can. So then when I went there, I picked her up. She said, well, what's the plan? So I said, well, you're going to go spend the night with me after I drop Dakota off. And then she said, okay.
And when you picked her up, was Dakota with you?
Yes, he was with me.
Okay, so it was just you two when you picked her up around 11?
Yes.
Okay.
So she was just in the back, just vibing to the music, and we're just talking, having fun. But Dakota seemed a little off.
According to McKinley, Melody then began offering to buy him some expensive items, like a PlayStation 5 from Amazon. It was also revealed that Melody was paying for McKinley's cell phone plan.
And he was like, damn, you must have a lot of money to be spending on him like that. And then she was like, yes, because she loved me. So then he was like, well, can we just ride around for a bit? It took a turn when she started arguing with him because he was like, you're being a little bit too bitchy because she was complaining about the song and shit. And I was like, hey man, chill the fuck out.
McKinley then drove to a local park where things escalated.
And that's when he was like, get out. And I was like, okay. And that's when he had a gun. And I'm like, what are you going to do with that? And he was like, don't worry, just shut the fuck up. So then she was in the back. She didn't know what was going on. But he told us to get out. And then he told me to pop my trunk. So I popped my trunk. And then he told me to get the duct tape and duct tape her hand. So at that point, I thought it was all a joke, you know? I thought it was literally all a joke. And then I was like, no, I'm not duct taping her hand. And then he took the gun and then he put it to the side of my head. And he was like, just do it. And then I just duct taped her hand. And then she was asking me what's going on, and I was like, I don't know. And then he was just saying, oh, she have money. I was like, no, she don't. She's like, yeah, she have money because she's willing to spend all that money on you and this and that. I'm like, that don't mean nothing. She doesn't even work. And he was like, well, we made it this far, so we might as well continue. Well, we can't let her go because if we do that, then we're both fucked because she's going to snitch on both of us. I'm like, I don't care if she snitched. I didn't do her anything.
McKinley was describing the situation where Dakota had forced him at gunpoint to become an unwilling co-conspirator in what was happening to Melody. He went on to say that he made several attempts to free Melody, but was stopped by Dakota each time. McKinley claimed that Dakota began hitting Melody and eventually forced McKinley to place her into the trunk of the car.
Well, she's been in the trunk for how long at this point?
The entire time we're driving, he telling him to, like, just let her go. And she kept pleading to me to help her. I keep saying, I can't because he has a gun. I'm going to try.
McKinley claimed that it was Dakota's decision to drive out to Lily Pond and stop the car there.
When we got to the pond, he told me to turn the car off and shut off the light. And then he took the keys and had them in his pocket. He opened her side door and he pulled her out. And then he started walking towards this picnicking area. I pretty much still doing the same thing, trying to talk to him. He's not listening. And she's screaming, help. And he was like, quit screaming and being a bitch, nobody's gonna hear you. So then when he got there, he got this rope. I don't know where he got it from, but it was a rope. And he was like, put your gloves on. I'm like, hey, can we just leave right here so you can go? Because I don't want to get involved in what you're doing. He's like, well, you're already in it. We already come this far, so we might as well. If you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. I ran back to the car because I know I have a second key on the side of the door. I ran back to the car, and I tried to get the key to start the car, but I realized it doesn't start the car because the chip is not in there. And he was like, what are you doing? I'm like, bro, I'm getting irritated. Like, you're doing too much. And then I pushed him, and then he pushed me. And then we got into a little shuffling.
According to McKinley, he stayed by the car while Dakota walked back over to where Melody was.
So, like, I just hear her, like, sound like somebody's being choked. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't see because after he went after her, that's all I could hear was just choking. I couldn't do nothing because I couldn't get out of there. So I was just pretty much just standing by the car, just like wishing like it would all stop.
In McKinley's version, not only did he refuse to participate in Melody's murder, but he'd made several attempts to try and help her, only to be stopped by Dakota, who was wielding a handgun. But the detective wasn't buying it.
I think the version that you just told me is probably about 50% true. There's a lot of truth in there, but right now you're hoping that given a lot of that 50%, that we'll start to not look at the other 50% that just doesn't match up. The part that I have a real problem with is your involvement in this. The idea that you're just some hapless guy that happened to be there that's in the back seat trying to cut her free, I don't buy it for a second. And all the while she's saying to you, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? In spite of the fact that you say that you're trying to help her, she's saying, why are you doing this? She doesn't appear to be getting the message that you're on her side. And so ultimately you audibly hear him doing something to her consistent with the sound of a choke or a strangle. And then ultimately he comes back
with her clothes and the bloody knife, and then he handed it to me. I was like, what do you do? He's like, he stabbed her. And then I dropped the knife.
And he told you I stabbed her.
Yeah.
He used those words, I stabbed her.
Yeah, I stabbed her to make sure she was dead. That's what she said.
To make sure she was dead.
And then I looked at the knife and I just dropped it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
While investigators doubted McKinley's version of events, they needed evidence to disprove his story. That evidence would come from a variety of sources, including McKinley's own actions in the days leading up to the murder. Just the day before, McKinley had changed his Facebook banner to an image of Jason Voorhees, the infamous Crystal Lake killer, who stalked his victims with a machete. The timing was chilling, given that McKinley and his friends would soon purchase their own machetes. But perhaps the most damning evidence came from interviews with people close to the suspects. Brandon Monson, a friend of Logan Kimpton's, revealed a disturbing conversation that occurred in Logan's car on the night of the murder.
I was with Logan Kimpton. I was in the rear passenger seat. I was told that he had a plan to go murder someone. And he said that it was going to be that night, the night of the murder. And when he said it, I didn't know if it was serious or not. Logan has been known in the past to joke around about that stuff.
The morning after Melody's murder, McKinley visited his friend Trevor with an unusual request.
The morning after. It was a Sunday morning, about 8:30, came knocked on my door, knocked on my window. I was sleeping. I then waved him over, come to the door. And then I opened my door. And then I told, then he was like, if somebody approaches you, ask you questions. Just tell him I was here all night playing video games. And it was kind of, you know, raised questions in my mind. I just said that he had to go, and then he proceeded to leave.
But perhaps the most chilling revelation came from a young woman named Taya Meyer, who described an unexpected late-night visit from Dakota Van Patten shortly after the murder.
He told me to come downstairs, and he asked if we can go upstairs. He tried to give me a hug. I said, no, get away from me. What is this about? Just get to the point. And then we headed upstairs. So I closed my door. I said, so what is this about? I want to go to bed. Like, what are you here for? Tell me, like, what's going on? And he was like, I killed someone. I said, who, why, what the fuck, what for? And he was like, that Melody girl. And I was like, for what? She didn't do anything to you. Who, why would you do that? Who with? What was the reason? He was like, with Ken.
Ken was the nickname used for McKinley amongst his circle of friends.
And then I said, for what? Why are you at my house? I don't want any part of this. I said, why did it happen? And he just said it had to be done. And he really didn't talk to me afterwards. I told him to get out. And the fact that you're going to tell me this is crazy. And I just don't want to be a part of it. That's, you know, that's not something you just tell somebody. He was just chill. No tears, no source of sympathy, nothing.
Based on overwhelming evidence and witness statements, police moved quickly to make arrests. McKinley Louisma and Dakota Van Patten were charged with first-degree murder and first-degree kidnapping. If convicted, they would face mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole. Logan Kimpton was also arrested and charged, though his role in the crime was different. According to investigators, while Logan helped purchase the weapons used in Melody's murder, he had chickened out before it actually took place, so he was charged with an accessory to the crime. In November 2024, McKinley Louisma was put on trial for Melody's murder.
Depraved, dehumanizing, defies reason. The evidence in this case will show that the defendant's actions, along with his accomplice, Dakota Van Patten, on February 17th into February 18th, 2024, were depraved. The evidence in this case will show that they kidnapped, killed, and mutilated Melody Hoffman in a manner that can be described as nothing less than dehumanizing. The evidence in this case will show, and we will lay out for you at the end of this case, multiple possible explanations for why he did this, but all of the explanations will defy reason.
Over the next 2 weeks, prosecutors presented an overwhelming array of digital evidence that proved McKinley, Dakota, and Melody had been together that night, tracking their movements from Cedar Rapids to Lily Lake through cell phone data, surveillance footage, and Melody's own Life 360 app. The defense placed all the blame on Dakota by focusing on one crucial fact. While Dakota's DNA had been recovered on a pair of gloves, Melody's glasses, and a bloody roll of duct tape, McKinley's DNA wasn't found on a single piece of evidence. While this surprising revelation initially seemed to open the door to reasonable doubt, the prosecution countered by reminding the jury that McKinley had admitted, in his own words during the interrogation, that he had touched every single piece of evidence. The prosecution also presented a horrifying photo they were able to recover from McKinley's phone. The photo, which had been taken and deleted on the night of the murder, showed Melody tied up and gagged with duct tape. There was also blood on her face, and she appeared to be crying. The jury couldn't ignore the words used in opening statements. Depraved, dehumanizing, defies reason. prosecutors also revealed a startling discovery that suggested a possible motive for Melody's murder. During the medical examiner's testimony, she testified that during Melody's autopsy, elevated hormone levels were discovered, which indicated that Melody was either pregnant or had been recently pregnant at the time of her death. It was a stunning revelation. Prosecutors argued that McKinley, caught between two pregnancies and two women, had decided Melody needed to disappear.
This is not a case where Dakota Van Pat randomly decided to order his friend at gunpoint for 4 hours so he could tie up his ex-girlfriend, take a cruise around the county, and then strangle, slash, and stab her because she might have some money or because they had a disagreement about the music. The evidence in this case has shown that the defendant was the leader of this conspiracy. He was the instigator of the brutality that was inflicted upon Melody Hoffman. He was the key driver of the kidnapping and the only person in this case with true motive and passion to do what he did to Melody Hoffman. But instead of letting her go, he continued to string Melody along, giving her hope they could get back together and taking advantage of Melody's feelings toward him, manipulating her. He even admitted that they hung out, and when they hung out, as you saw what he said, they had sex, which would explain the later findings that were made in the autopsy. And that secret Melody had, in this case you should infer, we believe the evidence shows, it led to a boiling point. The evidence in this case has shown that the defendant had a past with Melody Hoffman and that she wanted to have a future with him, but he didn't. The evidence has shown in this case that instead of just letting her go, he decided the best way to handle this is to eliminate the impediment.
In the end, it took the jury less than 2 hours to return its verdict.
State of Iowa versus McKinley Louisma. Count one, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder in the first degree. Count two, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of kidnapping in the first degree.
With this conviction, McKinley will serve a mandatory life sentence in prison without the possibility of parole. Melody's mother, Megan, expressed relief after hearing the jury's verdict by saying, "One down, two more to go," a reference to the upcoming trials of Dakota Van Patten and Logan Kempton.
We can't thank this whole team enough. They have been wonderful. I can't wait to continue to get justice for Melody with this team. She will be remembered for the person she is.
In Melody's obituary, Megan wrote, "She was the most loving and caring person who would help anyone. She knew no strangers, had no fear, and loved everyone unconditionally." This was Melody's true essence, captured in small moments, like when she walked up to the elderly woman at the mall to compliment her Christmas sweater. Not because she liked it, but simply because she wanted to see someone smile. She was a devoted daughter who spent her days helping her grandmother, a dedicated volunteer at the animal shelter, and someone who approached life with an open heart and genuine kindness. At just 20 years old, Melody saw the world with an innocence and optimism that was both beautiful and rare. Her greatest gift was her ability to spread happiness to others, to find ways to make people smile and love without judgment or reservation. In the end, that's how Melody should be remembered. Not for how she left this world, but for the light she brought to it while she was here. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.